This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from New York City, home of our affiliate WWRL and the headquarters here of Air America Radio, where I will be joining tonight in some of the play-by-play, as it were, as the returns are coming in. Just got a note forwarded to us from a fellow by the name of Cassidy in Brooklyn. He actually sent it to Louise. He said, I just wanted to give you a heads up. I was just turned away from my polling place in Brooklyn, New York, due to, quote, broken machines, end quote. They had no backup ballots and no idea what to do. They were just turning people away and telling us we couldn't vote. The one time New York actually matters in an election, very frustrated, Cassidy in Brooklyn. Whew! Well, today is the day. It's not necessarily the day. It'll probably, I suspect, for the Republicans, it'll be the day because I think all of the Republican races are winner take all, first past the post, winner take all, just like most of our national elections are. Whereas the Democratic Party has moved in the direction of proportional representation. Now, you know, obviously this is something that we should be doing at the national level. We haven't, but, you know, well, it would take a constitutional amendment, and I'm not sure I want to call a constitutional convention when there's as many Republicans running around loose as there are. But nonetheless, instant runoff voting obviously is something that doesn't require a constitutional amendment and could be implemented, and that's something we should all be pushing for. But that aside, the Democrats in most of their races have gone with proportional representation, which means that a couple of things. One, it means that in many cases, in many of the races, if the vote is really close, there are these thresholds that people have to hit to get more or fewer delegates. So you could have a situation where Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton win a particular state in terms of the raw vote total. But if it's by, you know, 48-52 or you know, something like that, then the delegates get split 50-50. There's a whole series of thresholds that you have to hit in order to change the number of votes that get passed out. The other thing is the Edwards thing. John Edwards is on the ballot in a lot of states, obviously. In fact, I think probably most states, maybe all of them, because, you know, obviously he'd been on the ballot all along. And some people are saying, well, yeah, I'm going to vote for John Edwards in the hopes that he'll end up with more delegates to take to the convention, just in case it's a brokered convention. And he decides that he has a preference, and I'll trust him with my preference. Here's the problem with that. He has to get 15% of the vote in order to have any delegates at all apportioned to him. And it's extremely unlikely that any candidate who's not actively running, that any candidate who has already declared that they're not going to run, is going to get 15% of the vote. And frankly, I don't think that, you know, there's enough of us in talk radio that we could drive that 15% of the vote. I mean, you know, we may have some influence over some voters, but, you know, not broadly. And there's no national organization out there. You know, MoveOn.org, for example, has endorsed Barack Obama, or their members have, rather. And so the national organization responding to their members has. But there's not, you know, anybody who I see could drive that 15%. And so as a consequence of that, the 15%, if you don't hit that 15% threshold, then all of your votes are considered as votes for whoever got the majority of the votes in that state. So if you're voting in a state, you know, whatever the state, I'm a vote. So, again, we've gotten a lot of calls on this over the last couple of days, people saying, you know, what should I do? You know, what each one of us needs to do is pick one of these two candidates and vote for them. And vote for them for the reasons that you would vote for them. I think it's really important in this election that we be voting for and not against candidates. And so anyhow, I just put that out and share it with you for your edification. We've got a great shoe today. Congressman John Spratt is going to drop by about the Bush budget. This is a disaster. It's a train wreck. And he's going to just share some quick thoughts with us here in probably about 10, 15 minutes. In the second hour of our program, we're going to start out talking with Mark Morano, the the Energizer Bunny of climate change denial, or whatever the, you know, he doesn't like that phrase, so I shouldn't call it that. What skepticism. And what I want to do with this conversation with Mark is highlight the fact that the EPA, is it the EPA that does it? No, it's not. Well, in any case, the Bush administration has said, we're going to put off the decision about whether or not to declare the polar bear an endangered species until after a vote is taken or after a decision is made to drill for oil in the middle of the polar bear's habitat. And this seems to me like extremely sleazy. And so we'll be discussing with Mark Morano in the second hour, is it really big oil versus the cute little polar bear, or the big polar bear? David Bender is going to drop by in our third hour. He's going to be doing, he's the senior political correspondent for Air America Radio. He's going to be doing election coverage from here from Air America headquarters tonight, live. I'll be dropping in for some of that. And he and Mark Green are going to carry the load, you know, most of that load. And it should be fascinating. So he'll be here at 3 o'clock Eastern time in the third, or 2 o'clock Eastern time, excuse me, the third hour of our program from 2 to 3 Eastern time. So that's what we have up for the day. Just a quick overview of a few of the things that are out there. I think that there's some very, very significant stuff going on. Let us not forget, in all the whoop-de-doop around voting today, that the Senate is still, there's still this ongoing discussion about FISA. The vote may happen today. Please call your senators. You have two. If you go to callcongress.org, you can get the toll-free phone numbers for Capitol Hill. And you simply, if you're not even sure who your senators are, simply tell them what state you're from, and they'll tell you who your two senators are, unless you're from Washington, D.C. And in which case, you can call somebody else's senator. And call both of your senators and say, hey, no amnesty for the phone companies and the Bushies who collaborated with them in spying on me and possibly on the Democrats. No amnesty. It turns out that the Bush administration is taking this even farther now. Great piece on this up at the top of thinkprogress.org. The Bush administration plans to install black box sensors on private sector computer networks. Now, this is a problem for two reasons. Expanding this NSA wiretap program and listening in on all our conversations. First of all, the Bush administration wants to expand this to the web. Ain't that wonderful? And secondly, by tying these things into these huge networks, there are a number of really highly credible and very savvy computer experts who are suggesting that what the Bush administration is doing by aggregating all this data in these centralized locations and downloading all these phone calls in some cases, or all the internet communications, all your emails, all of your my emails and things, by aggregating all that in one place, they're creating a hacker's paradise, and potentially even a terrorist hacker's paradise. So not only is this a violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees us privacy, but it's also stupid. So, I mean, this is nuts. This the story from Peter Swire, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He says the Bush administration wants to place more black boxes on private sector computer networks. We've already learned a lot about the NSA wiretap program and its NARUS STA-6400 splitter. That's the black box that AT&T whistleblower Mark Klein, reported the NSA placed at a major node for voice and internet communications inside secret room 6418. The president's budget wants to go much further. It moves beyond telcos and allocates $6 billion for a secretive system that is designed to protect government and private computer systems from attack. At least that's the theory, right? According to the Wall Street Journal, a White House proposal, quote, would likely require the government to install sensors on private company networks, end quote. So here we have, you know, Big Brother is at it again. And and frankly, you know, a lot of these private companies are very reluctant to have the government come in and attach stuff to their systems. And plus this, you know, all the privacy issues that this raises. It's just, this is... I'm frankly astounded that conservatives aren't outraged about this. I mean, obviously, Americans are outraged about this. But what happened to all these conservatives who, you know, back in the day used to yell about the government snooping in our business? Well, I know they want the government in our bedrooms, but this goes beyond that. 16 minutes past noon.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Yeah, today's the day. Get out there. Assuming you're in one of the Super Tuesday states. And vote. Well, we were talking in just before the break here about some of the boondoggles and mind boggles in Bush's new budget. Let's get the real expert on the topic here, Congressman John Spratt. He's the Democrat from South Carolina's 5th District, but perhaps more importantly, chair of the House Budget Committee. His website, house.gov/Spratt, S-P-R-A-T-T. And Congressman Spratt, welcome to the program.
Tom, nice to be with you.
Thank you. $688 billion for war?
Well, that's a tab.
Yeah, $3.1
trillion. The 688 is probably an understatement.
Yeah.
What the administration has done is provide a plug, $70 billion, for the supplemental cost of Iraq and Afghanistan in the year 2009, fiscal year 2009. They have told us that this is a plug. It doesn't represent the real number, but it's a placeholder until we develop the real number. Now, the corresponding number for this year, 08, for Afghanistan, Iraq, and to some extent North American air defense, is $196 billion. So the plug of $70 billion is the same as the item of $196 that they're now pressing as the cost of these wars in 2008.
Yeah. Now, this is mind-boggling. Now, Iraq is a country, as I recall, of around 30, 35 million people.
That's correct.
And so if we allocated $30 billion for Iraq, that would be $1,000 per Iraqi. If we allocated $300 billion, if I'm doing my math right, that would be $10,000 per Iraqi. So it seems like we're spending about half of that. We're spending about $5,000 per Iraqi. And this is a country where the average annual income is around $500. If we simply gave every Iraqi $5,000 and said, okay, here you go. Now go stimulate your own economy. Go rebuild your cement plants. Rebuild your, wouldn't it be money better spent? I mean, I just don't get where is all this money going?
Well, it's extremely expensive to do what we're doing there, and a lot of the money is not going to our troops.
Yeah, a lot of it's going to Halliburton and company.
Well, that's true, and it's going to train their troops. And to, for example, we now have these local militia that we've created ourselves among the Sunni returning against the Al-Qaeda. And you can count on it. We're bankrolling this group.
Yeah, and these are the guys who used to be attacking us and probably will again if they decide to change their allegiance. I think we're paying them... Is it $300 a month or something like that? I saw it in the New York Times a while back.
That's one reason it's so difficult to extricate our troops from that situation.
It is. So what are the other things in this budget that have raised your eyebrows, Congressman?
Well, the first thing is that this budget really leads us to, typically we use a budget to discipline the process to some extent and to hone in on a balanced budget sometime in the future. Well, this budget really makes the bottom line worse, at least in the near term, instead of better. We'll go back to a deficit of over $410 billion. I say over 410, even though that's the number they show. They are assuming in calculating that 410 that only $70 billion will be calculated into the equation for the cost of Afghanistan and Iraq over the next 5 years, only $70 billion, which is a plug. And secondly, they're assuming that after this year, the alternative minimum tax will kick in with full force and effect, and it will be effectively raising taxes for lots of middle-income Americans for whom it was not intended. That's not going to happen politically, but they assume that it will be happening, and that the AMT will be, to some extent, funding these out-year costs. If you back those two things out, put in a realistic number for the supplemental cost of the wars, and also recognize that you've got to patch the AMT so that it doesn't apply to these millions of middle-income taxpayers, then you've got a much bigger deficit than $410 billion, much bigger. The problem's even tougher than it appears to be, and it's the appearance is tough enough as it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, why would the Bush administration submit a budget that is so much smoke, mirrors, and nonsense?
Well, that's a good question to ask. The question I put is, this is the last time the Bush administration has to redeem its reputation for some kind of fiscal responsibility. Instead, they come up with what's Judd Gregg, don't take it from me, take it from Judd Gregg. What he called was
the
not
Republican.
Serious. Yeah, the Republican ranking member on the Senate Budget Committee. Very, very straight shooter. And he said, in effect, they're not taking this seriously. This is not even a serious exercise.
Hmm. And so even with the Republican, I mean, Judd Gregg, he's the Republican senator from New Hampshire, as I recall.
That's correct.
Wow. So what are you guys going to do? And by the way, we have about a half a minute here.
Well, we will endeavor to come up with a budget resolution of our own. It's not easy. It gets us to balance in the year 2012. How we do it is yet to be determined. Stay tuned. But our objective will be to genuinely hone in on balance by the year 2012.
Yeah. Well, good on you there, the Democrats and a few, you know, a few of the Republicans as well in the House and Senate who are committed to at least some semblance of fiscal sanity in the United States. Congressman John Spratt, thanks so much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our number 1-866-303-2270. Want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. Our blogs and message areas there, as well as over AirAmerica.com on the Tom Hartman page. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Young man sitting on the witness stand. The man with the book says, raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear. The man looked down at his long hair. And although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
And is that going to be what happens today? Are we going to see, as apparently the vote has come in from folks in Indonesia, Americans voting in Indonesia, that Barack Obama out ahead significantly, and John McCain as well. And American Samoa will be wrapping up voting shortly, I believe, if I have my facts straight on that. It's interesting. There's all this speculation about will people vote gender or age or race or that sort of thing. And I think to some extent, some very small extent that. But I don't know of any races. I mean, Geraldine Ferraro was the Democratic nominee in one race, and it didn't seem to produce a groundswell, you know, a huge number of women coming out to vote. I really think that people are going to be voting on A, the issues, the bottom line issues, and B, their sense of the candidates, regardless of their gender or their race or their age. Although the age thing, that actually, there is a demonstrated age effect. And you go back to the election in 1960 with John Kennedy, and you saw, you know, young people coming out in huge numbers for John Kennedy. And it has happened before. You know, I remember Clean for Gene McCarthy and others. So it's going to be really interesting to see. We're going to have a fine time watching this today. David in Sebastopol, California, calling in. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. What's up? Oh, I'll get better. Thanks for asking, David.
I watched the budget presentation on C-SPAN.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the administration's position is that we have to do something about the increasing costs of Medicare and Social Security.
Right, because together they almost equal the Iraq War.
Yeah, right. It's very important. But what's interesting is they presented a bar chart, which none of the reporters referred to and asked questions about. And what it shows is that the thing that's increasing most rapidly as a percentage of gross domestic product is the interest on the national debt.
That's right. Yeah.
And the national debt supports terrorism because we have no control over the 1/3 to 40% of the national debt that is owned by foreign entities, the largest of which, or the third largest of which, is Caribbean banking interests.
Yeah. And then there's also Saudi Arabia, which is the largest funder of Wahhabism, which is the Muslim sect, out of which Osama bin Laden and company derived. To hyper simplify, I realize, but nonetheless, what's the old saying? When you're driving alone, you're driving with Osama.
And it's so true. But they don't want to do anything about that. They want to go after healthcare.
Yeah, I know. This is what they, and David, thanks for the call. This is what they've been saying from day one. Roll back the New Deal. Roosevelt is dead, right? Roll back the New Deal. Get rid of that socialist Social Security program, that socialist Medicare program, and let's have some more wars. Tom in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Tom, great show, but it'll get better.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad to hear you on Denver again today. You were gone for a day, and you're back today. I'm not sure if that's permanent or not.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you.
And then I'd like to make a comment about Hillary and the war. She voted for the war. And, you know, I knew, and I think millions of other people knew, that we didn't have any evidence of weapons of mass destruction. And she voted for the war, I believe, out of ambition to become president. And she was willing to allow thousands of innocent Iraqis to die for that.
Tom, let me just recontextualize that, if I may.
Sure.
And let me preface this by saying that I am not an advocate for Hillary Clinton. I'm not a surrogate for Hillary Clinton. And, I've been talking about my vote would be a coin toss. It's probably a coin toss that would lean more toward Obama, but I think Hillary Clinton's a great candidate. But here's the bottom line. If you go back and you look at that resolution, now, I say all this in the context of it was wrong to vote for it, and the majority of Democrats in the House voted against it, and the majority of Democrats total who were elected in the House and Senate voted against it, although the majority of Democrats in the Senate did vote for it. But in any case, you look at that resolution. That resolution said that we could use force against Saddam Hussein if he refused to allow the inspectors in, or if the president certified that Saddam Hussein was directly involved in 9/11. And those were fairly high bars. And Saddam Hussein did, in fact, let the inspectors in part as a consequence of that being passed. And that's the defense that Hillary Clinton makes for her vote. And I think it's a reasonable defense. And the fact of the matter is that after about, 2 weeks after the invasion, George W. Bush actually did write a letter to the Senate and said in that letter, or to Congress, to the House and the Senate, and said in that letter that there was evidence that his administration did have evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11, and that was the justification for attacking Iraq. And I think that's an impeachable offense. He lied, he violated his oath of office. Those things, I'm frankly surprised that the Clinton campaign doesn't make that more clear and more visible. But that's what she's trying to argue, that it wasn't a vote for the war. It was a vote to get the inspectors in. And in that regard, it was successful.
And, Tom, I'm glad you say that because you have a way of articulating things that other people do not. And that really does assuage my concerns to some degree. I would vote for Hillary if she won, despite my concerns about that. I mean, I'm not going to allow a Republican to come into office. Can I say a couple of good things about George Bush?
Sure.
Well, first of all, he single-handedly saved Ronald Reagan from going down as the worst president in history.
Yeah.
Second,
no doubt about that.
He's made the Constitution fireproof by urinating on it every day.
Yeah.
And third, he's the most dishonest and incompetent and corrupt president in history. He's a dick.
His vice president is. But, yeah, he, thanks a lot, Tom, for the call. What he has done is he has united Americans, not just Democrats. He has united Americans in a way that I don't think could have been done. And, frankly, the Bill Clinton presidency had been kind of creeping more and more in the direction of Reaganomics, and the age of big government is over. You remember Bill Clinton gave that speech? I think it was 93 or 94. And they were moving in that direction of undoing the New Deal, do away with welfare as we know it, undoing the Great Society and things like that. And it took the insane presidency of George W. Bush to wake us all up. And I think that that's a fine thing. Brian in Beverly Hills, California. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I voted today already. I'm in California,
Mm-hmm.
And myself and a bunch of people got screwed at the polls this morning.
How so?
Because our names weren't on the roster.
You got caged.
Yes, basically.
So,
well, I don't know. I don't know exactly what happened, but I ended up, myself and a bunch of other people, ended up having to vote provisional.
Which are placebo ballots. They won't be counted if your name's not on the roll.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's a disaster. See, so, this is this. The Republicans have been so aggressive at this caging operation, you know, where they send out these pieces of mail to your home that looks like junk mail, and if you don't open it up and return the card, then they assert that you're not actually registered, and then you've got to go in and re-register. And
right.
they do it with the lists of registered Democrats. I mean, you know, it's how they knocked tens of thousands of people off the voting rolls in Ohio before the election in 2004, allowing Bush to steal that election. It's just mind-boggling.
Right.
Brian, I'm really sorry to hear that, and thanks for the report.
Do you know why they wait 30 days to count provisional ballots?
No, why?
No, I don't know. Oh. I was wondering if you knew.
Yeah, no, I didn't. Frankly, I didn't know that they waited 30 days to count them. I thought that they were supposed to. I'm assuming that these are state-by-state decisions, and different states probably have different periods of time. I do believe that the provisional ballots in Ohio from the 2004 election have not yet been opened and counted, and there was well over 120,000 of those. So,
right, exactly.
I mean,
so basically, I have waited for this day for a long time. I studied all the, you know, for the props and everything and listened to all the sides, and I really wanted my vote to count today. It's not.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. Brian, thank you for the call. Again, I opened the show with somebody here I'm in New York, broadcasting live from New York today, and somebody in New York saying the same thing happened to them in Brooklyn, a registered Democrat, sent us an email. Marcus in Washington, D.C. Hey, Marcus, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, good talking to you.
Thank you.
I have 2 points of issue, and I'll get off the phone. Number one, with either one of these potential presidential candidates on the Democratic side, what do you anticipate them at all rolling over in defeat, much like Kerry did and much like Al Gore did in 2000 and 2004, if Republicans run a real tough and narrow campaign? And number two, what kind of actions or controls can be put in place to indemnify our presidential candidate or our presidential hopeful at the time from all this crap that President Bush has put in place over the last 8 years?
Yeah. Well, the answer to number two is not much. I mean, you know, the signing statements, all the things that Bush has done, I mean, it's going to require some serious action by Congress. There's an enormous mess that needs to be cleaned up. With regard to whether the Democrats will fight back if it looks like we have another stolen election, like it was, you know, fairly clear in 2000 and 2004, frankly, to me and I think to many of us that there were stolen elections, and then there were a few around the country too. I mean, there was the one down in Florida, 18,000 votes went missing. There was one in California. There were several, you know, where the voting machines just went, oh, isn't this strange? I suspect that either the Obama campaign or the Clinton campaign will fight like hell. And I know, I mean, you know, we've known for some years that John Edwards and John Kerry, one of the reasons why they have a less than cordial relationship to this day is that after the 2004 election was apparently stolen in Ohio with the help of Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State in that state, who was also the chairman of the Bush for President Committee in that state, the guy responsible for counting the votes, is the chairman of the Bush for President Committee for the state. That after that happened, John Kerry rolled over and went away, and John Edwards wanted him to fight it. And frankly, a lot of us wanted him to fight it. You know, Al Gore, to his credit, fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. And, you know, it was nearly a month. I mean, that was a serious battle. And, you know, once you got screwed by the Supreme Court, as he says, you know, what are you going to do, have a revolution? I mean, after that, all you can do is investigate it. But, yeah, I think that the Democrats are going to fight it this time. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
There's nothing we can't do. Well, let me rephrase that. There's nothing that Bush has done that we can't undo. There you go. Welcome back. 866-303-2270. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Listening on WPTT. Hey, Janice.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I have to say I'm a little bit disheartened that you would slightly endorse Obama.
Well, let me unendorse him then, because the fact of the matter is that I live in Oregon, where we're not going to vote until May. And right now, I sit down with a list of the issues and the facts about the people, and I can build such a good case for Hillary Clinton. I can build such a good case for Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. I am really torn, and I have been going back and forth on this for days now, and Louise and I have been debating it is the wrong word, because it's like, you know, just trying to figure out, you know, I think that they're both strong candidates. And so I'm, you know, if that was taken as an endorsement of Obama, please allow me to retract it. I think that these are both excellent candidates, and anybody I would honor anybody who voted for either one of them.
Well, I just want to say that if Hillary doesn't get this nomination, and I was an Edwards supporter now, okay?
Yeah.
But I've been watching, and even my husband, who I love him so much because he is not afraid to say yes, a woman should be president. And he even pointed out to me she's getting beaten up unfairly.
Yep.
You know, Tim Russert, and Obama owned it, that he was the one coming from his campaign putting out all of those race issues into the media. And all Obama said was, well, it's the work of an overzealous campaign worker. He was not taken to task for that. He has been given such a free pass. And I tell you, I volunteer, I drag my kids to volunteer. I will not volunteer for another man, because a woman, especially a competent woman, is the true change that we should have in this country. And I'll tell you what, if she doesn't get the nomination, I'm going to vote for Cynthia McKinney and work for her if she's the Green Party nominee, because she truly is anti-war. She's female. She's more experienced than Obama. And I'm so tired of people not paying attention. He's not the clean, honest person that he portrays himself to be, and neither is she. But he gets a free pass, and as a woman, I'm so sick of it.
Yeah, I think that we are suffering, not just in America, but in Western civilization, from about 7,000 years of testosterone poisoning.
And
I say that as a man. My friend Ned Halliwell is a professor of psychiatry over at the Harvard Medical School, and he and I used to do a road show, you know, and talk about attention deficit disorder, because that's his specialty. And I was writing books on it. And we were sitting having lunch one day talking about illegal drug use, because it had come up in the workshop we were doing the day before or earlier that day. And he said, you know, the drug that causes more death than heroin, than cocaine, than anything else, that has caused more wars, that has caused more, you know, destruction and damage and ruined more lives. He says, it's testosterone.
Yep.
That's the most dangerous drug in the world.
Yep.
I'm not going to go out and get myself fixed, but I do acknowledge that. And I get your point. Janice, thank you very much for
the
call.
Thank you, Tom.
I appreciate it. By the way, I forgot to mention coming into this hour that our program today, proudly, brought to you by the 200,000 health and hospital workers of SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. And we are so pleased to have so many unions sponsoring this program on radio stations all over the country, as well as nationally. 1-866-303-2270. Shirley in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Shirley, what's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hello, Shirley. You're on the air.
Oh, good. I'm on the air. Just a minute. I'm going to take you off my speakerphone.
Thank you very much.
Hello there.
Hi.
I'm so glad you took my call. I am an avid Edwards supporter, and I want to get back and have people talk about him, because I just want them to know that he did not withdraw from the campaign. He suspended his campaign, which is a lot different, and he probably will not endorse. But I have a message that was put on by one of his headquarter people, and he says on there, continued battle was not going to serve our country well. And he says, take a breath and don't make any support decision yet.
Yeah.
I'm counseling all of you to keep your powder dry, to take time, take a deep breath.
It's wise counsel, Shirley. And thank you for sharing that. The point that Edwards is making is that he's about the issues, and we need to be about the issues too, and we need to be pointing it out to our list or to our friends and whatnot. I'm supporting this candidate because of this. Fill in the blank. You know, the issues. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Wonder buying people. Well, one, by the way, when somebody said that you're back on Denver, unfortunately you're not. They keep on starting with your signal and switching over to Eddie.
Yeah. Oh well.
Caucuskit.org is a website I created, which has predefined resolutions. One of the problems we have when people go to caucuses is they get their ideas for the resolutions at the caucus.
Right.
And we get all sorts of bad wording that we have to rectify once we're doing the party platform. So I recommend if you go to caucuskit.org, you can download resolutions you can take to your caucus.
Oh, cool.
C-A-U-S.
KIT.org.
Yeah, right. caucuskit.org. And the neat thing about this is one recommended thing is, you know, caucus, you actually can have much more power than usual. And I recommend you print out lots of copies of this because you can also affect the other caucuses. Frequently in a building, you might have 10 caucuses.
Right.
And so hand out, give the handout to people in the other caucuses.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Jeff, thank you very much. Steve in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Steve, just about a half a minute here before we get to wrap up this hour.
Hey, Tom, quick question for you. Okay, that stimulus package they're trying to put through, is that going to be in, like, the last rebate we got that, you know, back in 01, which was really just in advance on the tax refunds that we were going to be getting anyway?
Yeah, it was kind of a joke, wasn't it? Frankly, nobody knows right now, Steve. You know, the House has passed a version of it. It's gone to the Senate. The Senate is adding stuff to it. The president is saying he's going to veto it if some of that stuff is still in it. You got Republicans and Democrats fighting about it in the Senate. And then after the Senate passes their version, which is absolutely somehow going to be different from the House version, even if they take out the more controversial provisions, then it goes to what's called conference committee, which is where the House and Senate reconcile it and come up with a new version, which could be anything. So the bottom line is right now, nobody knows. Nobody knows. But we'll see shortly. My concern about the stimulus package is that most of it's going to take effect in the late summer, just in time to help the economy in time for the elections, thus helping the Republicans.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman. Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. Today, by the way, the fifth anniversary of Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations. We'll get into that a little later on in the program. But right now, there's a real battle brewing. We talked earlier about the amnesty for the phone companies and for the Bush administration for spying on people here in the United States illegally and without warrants. But there's another political debate going on in Washington, D.C. right now. And this has to do with the failure to list, it's not the delisting, the unlisting, the not listing polar bears as a species, as an endangered species. And moving up the drilling leases. They're going to tomorrow. The sale of drilling leases is supposed to begin, despite the objections of Native Alaskans and environmentalists. And so Mark Morano joins us. He is the communications director for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Actually, now that you're on the Inhofe staff, excuse me, Mark.
Minority, yes.
Yeah, the minority communications director. Thank you.
We were the voters demoted us.
Yeah, the vote. Yeah, in fact, Barbara Boxer's now the majority, right?
Yeah, she's the chairman.
She's the boss. As she famously told your boss once.
During the Al Gore hearing with the gavel, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Called that well.
Yeah. And the website, epw.senate.gov. And, Mark, first of all, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm happy to be back on here.
The polar bears, this boggles my mind. Here you guys are saying, okay, let's not talk about the polar bears until after we've sold off the oil leases to drill right in the middle of the territory where the polar bears live, so we can discuss after we've decided to drill there and after we've sold off the leases whether or not we should protect them. This doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, first of all, I don't really have a comment on that. That doesn't have anything to do with our committee, and I have no inside information or knowledge on this whole issue with the leases. I can tell you that any minute or any day, the decision is expected on whether they will list the polar bear. And I can, you know, and as you pointed out, there's a lot of controversy over these leases right now.
Yeah, but I mean, you have the Interior Department this whole listing, it's like the administration is using different arms of the administration to advance the interests of the oil companies, frankly, it seems to me.
Well, the thing is, with the polar bears, it's a very simple concept. There are more polar bears now, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, according to even environmental groups can see. The numbers are way up in the last 50 years. They're at historic highs.
We have about 25,000 polar bears now. There were around 5,000 in the 1950s. But that's still only about 60% of what the population was.
Well, was when, though? I mean, not,
well,
not,
was 80, 90 years ago.
You know, that's...
What's considered a sustainable long-term population for the polar bears? Plus, their habitat is starting to disintegrate because of global warming.
Well, a couple things on that. First of all, the models that show that polar bears are facing, you know, grave threat of endangerment are based on speculative computer models of Arctic ice. Now, there's a major study just out with a Harvard astrophysicist and two forecasting experts, one from the Ivy League Wharton School named Scott Armstrong, top forecaster in the world, who's basically calling the task the methodology used in these. There's a couple issues.
Then why are all these countries fighting for rights to put ships through the water that is opening up as the ice is vanishing, and why can we see it going away on Google Earth?
Well, no one's disputing that the ice has been reduced, but as you read the U.S. Senate Minority Report on polar bears as of last week, we go through about a half a dozen peer-reviewed studies showing that the ice breakup was due to natural causes, everything from unusual winds to more sunny days to ocean currents. You cannot look at this as a temperature issue when it comes to this only.
Mark, you're using the tobacco argument. What you're saying, it's like the tobacco companies used to say, oh, that case of cancer in that guy, you can't prove that that came from Lucky Strike. Because it doesn't have the logo on the cancer cells. Some of the effects of global warming can't be proved that it's caused by human effects because there are also natural effects that cause global. Well, of course, but that doesn't mean it disproves it.
No, but I mean, specifically, a NASA study pointed out and said that the reduction in sea ice of the older, thicker ice was specifically due to unusual winds, not higher temperatures.
And you don't think unusual winds are the result of climate instability that might have something to do with the fact that the atmosphere is getting warmer?
That's something you need to take up with the authors of this, because they literally will say natural causes. Even the Associated Press Seth Borenstein was forced to write sort of tongue-in-cheek, but he wrote an article talking about natural causes for this. My point being, you can't look at the Arctic and say, as we talked about on this, the Antarctic is at record sea ice last winter in the Antarctic.
Right, which is a predictable consequence of global warming. There's more precipitation.
But then another study came out and said, oh, maybe it's losing ice because of warmer ocean currents, which then the models...
On the edges.
You know, and Greenland, of course, has cooled since the 1940s, or at least flatlined in terms of temperature. You can't look at a few years of temperature data, and even 3 decades is considered a few years, as it is in the Arctic, and then extrapolate with these computer models.
Mark, you've got 100, almost 100 parts per million increase in carbon dioxide levels, you know, in the atmosphere here. We've gone from 300 and change to approaching 400 and change. And, I mean, this is historic, just over the last 50 years, and you're saying, we can't look at a couple of decades, but it's those couple of decades when we've been pumping hundreds of billions of tons of carbon dioxide every year into the atmosphere.
80% of man-made CO2 came after 1940, when temperatures cooled till the mid-1970s. And yes, they did warm, and the high point is still 1998, and depending on which data set you use, we've essentially been on a negative or even a flat line or slightly negative since 2001. So where is this correlation? You had 20
Nine of the warmest years in the history of the planet have been during the last 11 years?
Again, depending on the data sets, we have new studies out that show the medieval warm period was warmer long before SUVs or coal plants. We have actually two papers.
You had satellites back then?
2007 had two papers showing the 20th century was not anomalously warm, and another one showed the medieval warm period was warmer. These are peer-reviewed papers.
Two papers?
Well,
I'm impressed. I mean, the IPCC has, what, 30,000 papers?
No, I mean, there are actually hundreds showing the medieval warm period was warmer until the UN promoted Michael Mann's hockey stick in the 2001 report. Notice that I believe it doesn't even appear at all in the 2007 report, in the UN report. They've now shied away from it. Even the National Academy of Sciences has said that a lot of the claims were unsupportable. So the point being, if the temperature today is not outside the range of natural variability, and it's not, then all we have are these speculative computer models. And that's what our Senate report at epw.senate.gov goes to the heart, especially when it comes to polar bears. A couple of schools of thought. There's no danger right now of polar bears in any kind of endangerment as a population. Even if they were to lose the ice, we have, quote, very esteemed biologists showing that they would still do just fine with less ice. And then the other issue is whether the ice is actually going to go away and whether these computer models of the ice reduction
are any good. Well, I think the question in the context of this drilling that you guys want to do is not whether they do better with or without the ice. It's whether they do better with or without giant oil drilling operations in the center of their habitat.
Well, you know, that's absolutely a complete completely separate argument in terms of, you know, in terms of my jurisdiction and anything else, and related to me. However,
okay, well, let me just ask you that what I think is the big question.
And that's an issue that, you know, that's an issue that they're trying to debate now, whether we drill in Anwar and other places up
right,
in the Arctic.
Right. This is the big question.
By the way, Antarctica was set aside during the Cold War as no development. It's just a scientific research. But
right.
I think it was 1959. The South Pole was set aside.
Yeah, but it's also pretty damn hard to develop anything down there anyway. I mean, you've got
sure.
100 feet of ice underneath you. Here's the question. I mean, and oddly, John McCain spoke to this the most eloquently during the last Republican debate, in which one of the guys on stage, I forget which one, was saying, "Oh yeah, there's no global warming," you know, quack quack quack.
And Fred Thompson.
Yeah, probably Fred Thompson. Yeah. Well, if he woke
he
up long enough,
no.
usually his every other sentence was. but in any case, and John McCain said essentially, I'm paraphrasing here. I don't have the quote in front of me, but I watched him say it. And heard him say it, you know, basically, if you guys are wrong and we go ahead and reduce carbon dioxide emissions and reduce consumption of fossil fuels and promote alternative energies, then we will have cleaner air, regardless of the CO2, and we will have a cleaner planet, and we will develop new industries, and we will be giving less money to the Saudis and ultimately to the bin Ladens of this world. And the world will not have melted down. If you guys are wrong, there could be a disaster and we will have done nothing. It seems like the reasonable thing to do is to take these precautionary steps to say, no, we're not going to do more drilling because that's going to lead to more consumption of fossil fuels. And instead, we're going to take that money and we're going to promote renewable energy with it.
Well, there's a very simple and absolutely concrete answer to that. People always say, well, what if you're wrong? We're facing a catastrophe. If you guys are right in terms of, you know, say we are facing a climate crisis, there has not been one realistic proposal going back to the 1980s that would have had any measurable impact, essentially, on global temperatures. That includes Kyoto. That includes Lieberman-McCain. That includes...
Then why don't you join... Why don't you help us come up with one?
No, my point is that it's not a question of... If this were an insurance policy, it'd be someone saying, well, we'll buy an insurance policy in your home, you pay a huge premium for no payout. That's what every one of these cap and trade bills do. We don't need a federal bureaucracy. It's technology. It's bringing in the developing world. That's the way forward, and that's for geopolitical reasons, as you rightly mentioned, to get off of a reliance on fossil fuels. There's nothing wrong with that.
All right, Mark Morano, the Communications Director of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, epw.senate.gov. Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate the dialogue.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I'm going to show you how to take control. Got to vote, yeah, you know how it goes. But y'all looking for the cars and clothes. And this other man hope is that y'all don't vote. Because even he know majority rules. Keep majority of the minority fooled. Your vote really does matter, dude. And that attitude, government's loving it. So if you're looking for your retribution, be part of the problem or the solution. Really, all due respect, kid. Voting is free, last time I checked it. Look at he crooked and he connected. You don't vote, then he getting reelected. See, I'ma tell him in the style of a rhyme. We can change the world with one vote at a time. Come on, if you don't vote, don't.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past there, excuse me. And if you're having problems voting, we've had a number of people call who've had problems voting. I've gotten a number of emails from people who have shown up at the polls and discovered that as Democrats, they're no longer on the voting list, no longer on the voting rolls. Apparently, the Republicans have been out doing their caging work and doing it quite well. If you have a problem, the People for the American Way is aggregating that information, looking for trends and things, and they may be able to help you out or at least offer some advice and, at the very least, keep track of the trends. So give them a call. If you have a problem voting, their number is 866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E, 866-OUR-VOTE. And their website, pfaw.org, as in People for American Way. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Ryan in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just listening to Mark's comments, and you were absolutely right. He was using that same sort of nonsense mathematical logic of dismissing the statistics because they don't show necessarily a causal relationship between rising CO2 levels and climate change.
Right, which is impossible to prove, just like it's impossible to prove that that particular lung cancer came from this particular cigarette.
Exactly. No such study exists, but we have a very reasonable and academic understanding that such a relationship exists.
Yeah.
And the same happens. I mean, we've done these meta-analyses, and we've aggregated hundreds, as you said, hundreds of studies that have, on the aggregate, shown that there is a trend. And he's finding, what do you say, a dozen studies that may show otherwise?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's really discounting some very powerful statistics that we've come up with. And it was quite nonsense to listen to some of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you, Ryan, for your comments. And one of the reasons why, you know, I continue to have Mark on and have these conversations, and will continue to have conversations with conservatives on a wide variety of issues, is because you are going to hear these talking points. You're going to hear them a lot. You're going to hear them more and more and more. And I think it's frankly useful for people to have the ammunition to talk back, you know, to see it modeled, as it were, and also for all of us to be party to these discussions. The election, obviously, the big issue of the day. Today is Super Tuesday. Charlotte, New York City, you want to talk about that?
Hello?
Hey, Charlotte. Hi, you're on the air.
I'm on the air?
You are.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you for waiting so long.
Yes. I just wanted to say, because I was so disappointed in you yesterday. I'm listening to Air America since day one. And I really was upset. Because you seem to show your preference for Barack Obama.
You know, it's funny because I've gotten probably 100 emails from people complaining about the fact that we've had about a 2-to-1 ratio of spokespeople for the Clinton campaign versus the Obama campaign on our program. And that's just been largely a function of, you know, who's available to come on when. It's not anything intentional on my part to favor either candidate. And
well, yeah, what bothered me about that was that, you know, a lot of people could be influenced.
But yesterday I had John Kerry on speaking for Barack Obama, and then we had another senator on, I forget who it was.
Yes, I heard it.
Speaking on behalf of Hillary Clinton, who actually spoke longer than John Kerry did. So, I'm Charlotte, I get your point, and I did make a comment earlier today that a number of people thought was a kind of side-handed endorsement of Barack Obama.
Yeah, because I always thought you were neutral.
Yeah, and I am neutral, and I am going to continue to be neutral, and that was an ill-advised comment on my part, and you know, I can build a strong case for either candidate, and I will be very happy with either one of them. So, Charlotte,
well,
Charlotte.
I just feel that Hillary, you know, far exceeds Barack Obama. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
And originally it was Edwards.
Yeah.
But,
well, and
Hillary is my choice at this time.
Good. And I encourage you to vote for her and you know, get your friends out there, too. We need to get as many people out there.
Well, I usually work for the elections, the Democratic Party in my area. So, but I just had to tell you how upset I was yesterday.
Well, thank you for venting, Charlotte. I appreciate your call. I got to move along, though. Doug in the Bronx. Hey, Doug, got about a minute here before a break.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks a lot. I have a lot of things to say. You know, what I fear about Barack Obama, if he were to be the nominee, is that the basis of voting on emotion is the problem and not voting on I'm a wonk. I have to apologize to so many young people.
No, I understand, but the reality
I'm
is that more than 90% of Americans ultimately do vote on emotion.
And that's bad, and that's unfortunate.
But it's the reality.
But the point is, what is the emotion based on? It's as if he's an empty suit, and I've heard this said. He has no foundation, really. There's nothing behind him. I mean, yeah, I know.
Well, I think
that
in some ways he's kind of a national Rorschach test. You know,
a great deal of the emotion is an anti-Clinton emotion, and what is that based on? Nothing. It's irrational. I do disagree with you when you say that he was trying to dismantle the New Deal. No, he wasn't.
Who? Barack Obama?
No. President Clinton in the 90s.
No, I said in two areas he participated
in
the dismantling.
Yeah, I know, and I've heard that a million times.
Yeah.
You know, the unfair singling out of Clinton on her vote. Did anybody vote for John Forbes Kerry 4 years ago? He voted the same exact way.
I know, and I voted for him and supported him. Doug, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you for the call.
To listen to your mother.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Strange days indeed.
Indeed. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting the local radio station you're listening to by supporting their sponsors, letting them know that you're listening. And also brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers of SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And it is a right in every other industrialized country in the world. But here it's only a privilege, and it's only a privilege for the privileged few. What a tragedy. 1-866-303-2270, our number. Todd in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Todd, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm just great. What's up?
Hopefully I'll be getting better. I'll fill that
okay.
in for you.
Yeah. I already said it today, and I have a limit of once a day.
Right, exactly, yeah. We had spoken before about atheism a couple months back, if you remember that.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to try and help out again today. I thought you did a really good job with the gentleman you were just speaking to about the environment in giving the quick rebuttal to his statements that he would throw out about, you know, snowing in Antarctica and things like that. I thought you did a really good job with that. One of the things that I don't know if you weren't aware of or if you just were tired of parrying all of his points was that the reason that those that are trying to refute global warming always use the 1940s and 1970s benchmark
is because those were unusual.
It's not only that those are unusual, but one of the latest studies there was a cooling trend from the 40s to the 70s.
Right.
And so they always bring that up whenever they use their data. They always add that in. So he'll say it's flatlined since the 40s, which means it went down and then it went back up, and the trend is that it's still going up.
Mm-hmm.
But mathematically, he'll say that the average is that it's flatlined.
Right. So if you take it from the 70s forward, you've got a whole different set of numbers.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And if you took just the 40s to the 70s, and that's why they'll say, oh, there used to be all this worry about a great ice age. Well, when I was a young man, or a child, I remember those conversations in the early 70s because there was a downward trend. One of the ideas that's been posited for that, which seems to make a lot of sense, is first of all, do you know what the word albedo means?
My understanding is that the cooling between the 40s and the 70s was a consequence of a dramatic and rapid increase in particulate air pollution, which was reflecting back into space a lot of heat that wasn't making it to the Earth. And in the 70s, we started cleaning up our pollution, you know, EPA, things like that. And that increased then the amount of sunlight getting through and the amount of heat getting through. Is my recollection consistent with your understanding?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. The albedo is the reflectivity of the planet.
Right.
So the Earth's albedo dropping as a result of the ice caps melting.
Right. There's that too.
Right.
And now the problem that we have is that with China coming online and India coming online, we're back. You know, they're back to pumping a whole bunch of stuff into the air. And I've actually, you know, we had one scientist on this program, I think it was about a year ago, who was saying, you know, if we were to tomorrow morning in a flash, in the snap of a finger, clean up all the particulate, you know, crap that's in the air, all the crud that's out there, that the increase in the ability of heat to strike the Earth would be so significant that you'd see a very sudden warming.
Exactly.
It's like a knife's edge that we're walking. It's like, you know, every step has to be considered because there's the law of unintended consequences comes in really big time.
Right.
Todd, I've got to move along. I've got a lot of other calls, but thank you very much for calling and sharing your insights with us as always. 1-866-303-2270, Stephen in Burbank, California. Hey, Stephen.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm hearing callers accusing you of being biased towards Obama. But the fact of the matter is, you've been saying the same thing for years that I heard Obama just say the other day, and that is movements come from the ground up. And Obama is saying we, and work with we, and us, do it.
Yeah.
You know, and also in regards to the Constitution, I heard him talking about restoring habeas corpus, and he's...
Well, the fact of the matter is, though, that Hillary Clinton is on record in favor of restoring habeas corpus, and Hillary Clinton is also talking about energizing the electorate and getting people involved. I mean...
Okay, I didn't hear her say that, but a point I would try to make is... No rogue Supreme Court can negate the Constitution. No legislature,
Amen.
No Congress can negate. The only way the Constitution changes is by constitutional amendment. And when they say it's legal, it just, you know, make people believe it's legal. It's not. They're wiretapping our phones before 9/11.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And that's something that we forget at our peril. Stephen, thank you very much for the call. And Yep. It's Ina in Long Island, New York. Hey, Ina. Am I pronouncing it right, or is it
yes.
Ina?
No, it's Ina.
Ina. I'm sorry.
Hello. That's okay. I just wanted to say, first of all, that I've been listening to your show since its inception on Air America, and I really find your intelligible debates and discussion very, really wonderful to listen to.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I called today because I've been so busy with deciding who I'm going to vote for. And I was waiting for some sort of bolt of lightning to come down. And today when I heard your caller say, give reasons why she's voting for Hillary, I was really very taken and said, yep, there it is. Mm-hmm. So I am going to vote for her today.
Okay.
I had read the article by Paul Krugman about the health insurance, and that was another reason.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with Paul Krugman that her health insurance plan is a better plan. I also, you know, on the one hand, and on the other hand, I'm concerned about the fact that she's taken more money from defense contractors than any other candidate, including all the Republicans.
Right.
And so it's like, okay, there's a plus and a minus. And with Obama, you know, there's this plus of, you know, his rhetoric is extraordinary and soaring, and the minus is he's held federal public office for all practical purposes about a year and a half. I mean, the rest of the time he's been running for president, and he's only been tested in one federal election at the federal level, and that was against a guy who was a cartoon character, Alan Keyes. And so there's just a lot of unknowns there. I said to my last caller, I think he's in a way sort of a national Rorschach test. We're all projecting onto him our greatest hopes, or in some cases our greatest fears, and certainly in the cases of, you know, the wackos and racists out there and those people who are horrified by his middle name, their greatest fears. And that's why he has to define himself as quickly as possible, because Hillary Clinton has been, you know, everybody pretty much knows who she is, or at least thinks they know who she is.
Well, that's been my concern all along, is that she has, you know, we've known her for a long time. She's had her good and her bad points and things that she's done that I'm not unhappy with, and Iraq is one of them. But, you know, Barack, he's an unknown entity. And although he really has given birth to the youth out there to want to vote, which I think is fabulous, I don't really know him.
Yeah.
And as the other caller said, I would like a change from a male testosterone to a female.
Okay.
And I think it'll be a breath of fresh air.
Okay. I got your point, and I've got to move along. But thank you very much for your kind words and for your comment. John in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I'd like to speak to the thought that anti-Clinton sentiment is unfounded, and I'd like to explain it briefly. Clinton was a wonderful president. I did some fantastic things for the country. Unfortunately, the Monica scandal, people don't understand unless you relate to Republican right-wingers and conservatives on a regular basis, how much that meant to them. And I see it as a door opening for the last 8 years, seven and a half years.
But see, those people aren't going to vote for a Democrat no matter what.
Well, it managed to undo all the good that he had done. And it opened the door that allowed, you know, the right-wing wackos in there to undo everything that he had done. And quite frankly, I can't forgive him for that. And also, it'll open up this, everybody's going to crawl out of the foxholes on both sides, and it'll reopen this constant...
John, it's going to happen no matter who the nominee is. If the nominee is Hillary Clinton, I guarantee you the Republicans are going to be out there, and you're going to be hearing Monica Lewinsky's name, among other things, constantly. And Rush Limbaugh is going to be running his Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox advertisement, and you know that he rolled out a couple of years ago. I mean, that's going to. On the other hand, if Barack Hussein Obama is the nominee, then you're going to have Rush Limbaugh playing his Barack the Magic Negro song, and you're going to have, you know, all this kind of racist hatred and hysteria about Muslims and that viral lying viral email that's running around.
I think they'll be a little more polite, Tom. I really do. I think the righties will be a little more polite.
Nah, John. I'm sorry. You are giving these guys far too much credit. They play to win, and they believe that the ends justify the means, and if lying is the means, they will do it. And they have demonstrated it time after time. This didn't originate with Lee Atwater. He turned it into a science, but it's been going along. I get your point, but I respectfully have to disagree. John, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Jim in Berkeley, California. Hey, Jim, we We got about a minute here before this next break. What's up?
All right. Well, I will try to be quick. I was really surprised, in particular, at the call in the last hour, the person who said that they'd be working for Cynthia McKinney if Barack Obama got the nomination, but working for Clinton if she got the nomination. I'm really starting to get tired of hearing about the testosterone poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
If we think that a woman in office is necessarily going to be better than a man in office, I would encourage people to remember Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
You already mentioned, I think, that Hillary has taken more money from the military-industrial complex than all of the other candidates. Well, not all the other candates combined, but more
than any other candidate on either side.
You know, Mark Penn, Burstyn Marsteller, her saying in the debate that lobbyists are people too, because, well, nurses have lobbyists, so I'm proud of my lobbyist contributions. There's, you know, a lot of feminist writers, including Laura Flanders, Frances Kissling, and so on, Katha Pollitt, who said that for feminist reasons, they cannot support Hillary Clinton because of her record.
I understand, Jim. I understand. And again, you get how confusing this all is. These are both great candidates, and these are both candidates that have a strong potential to be attacked by the Republicans. Let's put it that way. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
If you don't get out of vote this year, you're really not moving. It takes every one of us to keep the country moving. You can make it to the polls, you can get together. Won't you meet me there, we'll vote, we can make things better.
Get out there and vote! If you're in one of the Super Tuesday states, if you're not, well, you can still participate. There's blogs, there's message boards, there's candidates who you can give campaign contributions to. There's ways you can participate. Also, we need to be participating in our democracy right now, like calling your senator and saying, please, your senators, and saying, please, no amnesty for Bush and the phone companies who colluded with him in criminal activity. No amnesty for Bush and the phone companies. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And Ellen, is the vote in from American Samoa yet?
You know, I believe it is. They voted it they were done by today at 12:30. So I think it is, but I don't know what it is. But speaking of Super Tuesday, the Hillary Clinton campaign just had a conference call. Actually, it's still going on, but LaVise is an expert at doing two things at once. And essentially, first of all, they said that there were irregularities in Arizona polls, that they said registered voters are not on the list, they have ID problems, and they weren't provided provisional ballots. Now, a lot of people think that Obama's going to win Arizona, so that's kind of interesting. But they have now.
Well, I've heard from voters in Michigan and California. I'm sorry, in New York City and in Manhattan, in the Brooklyn, as I recall, and in Southern California, who showed up registered Democrats who showed up and their names were not on the rolls. They'd apparently been caged.
So this has clearly been going on in a lot of states. But anyhow, if you want to report it, Hillary Clinton set up a website at hillaryclinton.com/action/polling-problems. So
the people for the American Way are doing the same thing over at pfaw.org, and they have a phone number, 866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E, for anybody who's been caged.
Right, and you can imagine that this is going to happen. If it's happening now, it sure as heck is going to happen in November.
Gotcha.
The Hillary Clinton folks are also saying that they see themselves winning, but they think it's going to be inconclusive. They're saying, this is from the Hillary camp, that it may go all the way to the convention, and that they're surprised that Obama is using Republican talking points. I guess he said something like universal health care is like telling homeless people to buy a home when he was talking about the Hillary Clinton plan today on television.
The mandating it. Yeah, I mean, this is where I wish both of them would just get with the plan and say, okay, Medicare for everybody, and, you know, we don't need those stinking health insurance companies. But apparently neither one of them is willing to say that.
That's for sure. Hillary Clinton said that they would like one date of a debate per week, one-on-one, with Obama through March 4th.
Wow. That's, yeah. I'm not sure I could handle
all that. Not either.
That's a lot. Are they talking about regional or are they talking about nationally televised?
They didn't say.
If they're regional debates, that makes a lot of sense actually, because it gives people in different parts of the country an opportunity to show up and you know get a sense of the candidates. If we're talking about once a week having a nationally televised debate, well, you know the good side of this, speaking as a Democratic partisan or you know somebody who's more attracted to the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, let's put it that way, that odds are. My guess is, and I'd love to hear your take on this, Ellen, that by the end of tonight, we're going to know who the Republican nominee is. And if we don't know who the Democratic nominee is, that means that for the next X number of months or weeks, and perhaps months, it's going to be all the publicity, all the news stories are going to be about the Democrats because there's still a race going on, and the Republican nominee is going to fade into obscurity.
Well, yeah, tonight is going to certainly be very interesting. If I can just switch topics just briefly here.
Please.
Senate Finance Committee was run by Max Baucus today. Secretary Paulson was the person talking and defending their budget. They said that, what basically Max Baucus said is that avoiding recession is completely unrealistic and that this idea that they're going to balance the budget by 2012 is completely unrealistic, that they're also expecting that there's going to be cuts in Medicare and Medicaid by the president's budget are going to be devastating to older people and people who are disabled. And his response, Secretary Paulson's response, is the economy could not handle any increased taxes.
Jeez.
This
is so going to help the Republicans in the election. I'm being sarcastic. I mean,
no, I understand. I think Bush is just stupid, or he must want a Democrat to be elected.
Or he's following the ideology. I mean, they still believe in Reaganomics. I mean, even though it's been discredited, it's been disproven, it was ridiculed at the time by Bush's dad, which is probably why he's holding on to it so tightly. But they're still going down this Reaganomics road. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts.
A couple other things that there is a vote on the stimulus package. That is going to happen on Wednesday, and, of course, they're hoping that they get their senators back to do that. And
just a quick question about that, Ellen. How close is the Senate stimulus package now to the House package that it probably will survive conference?
Well, no, it's still pretty different.
Yeah.
But of course, they're voting on several amendments, so it may turn out to be very different at the point that it actually happens.
So, and that may ultimately, one of two things, either we're going to end up with a very different bill than anything we've seen from either one of them when it comes out of conference, or it may not even make it.
That's right. I think it's going to have to make it, because the point is, without having to make it, they're all going to come back to their districts, Republicans and Democrats alike, empty-handed, and nobody wants to do that.
Well, and the Republicans want to make it because they don't want the economy to be in the tank for the November elections. And most of the stimulus is going to happen in, you know, they start mailing the checks out in May, they finish mailing them in July. You're going to see the bump in the economy in September, October, and November, just in time to make the Republicans look a little less bad for the elections.
Exactly, although I got news for you. I think that the economy is going to do so bad that even with the stimulus package, it's going to need a lot of help.
Yeah, it's already in the tank. I mean, it's and we've seen the steady deterioration of wages for among wage earners, you know, working people across the United States. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
It's always great having you on. Thanks for dropping by. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking with David Bender, the senior political correspondent for Air America Radio. David and I will be doing some election coverage tonight, along with Mark Green and a whole bunch of other folks going to be dropping by. So stick around. We'll be talking with David, and then we'll be taking your calls for the rest of the hour about the election today. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. And with us on the line is David Bender. He's the senior political correspondent for Air America Radio. And David and Mark Green are going to be doing live election coverage this evening that'll be carried on many of our Air America affiliates. And, of course, on our web stream at airamerica.com. And I will be dropping in for a short while during that. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom, and not only will you be dropping in, but at the same time you're dropping in, I'm now able to tell you that I think Senator John Kerry will be stopping by.
Yeah, I just got that note, plus Barbara Boxer and Mayor Villa. You know, I interviewed the guy last week, and I couldn't pronounce
his name. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Villaraigosa.
Villaraigosa, thank you. Is that Gary Hart, the Hart on this list?
Gary Hart is the Hart on the list.
Great, and Al Franken? Al Franken and me and Lionel and a bunch of us. We're going to have a party.
It is a party, and you know, there are 24 states, 22, I think, on the Democratic side, 24 overall. We're trying to cover as much ground as we can and have people from all of Minnesota. Well, you mentioned Al Franken. Mm-hmm. Minnesota is caucusing tonight. And mm-hmm. In fact, Senate candidate Al Franken will be calling in from his own caucus after he's participated.
Oh, that's great. We had him on the program yesterday, and it is always great to hear Al's voice back here on air.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a good guy. And I, with regard to the primary in Minnesota, I will let the voters of Minnesota decide, because I frankly I'm not there and I don't know the all the issues and everything, but you know, with regard to Norm Coleman, man, that guy is toxic.
Yeah, no, there's no decision involved there.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, and I'm sure Al talked about this with you yesterday, that there are now polls out that show, and Al is, to be fair, he is not yet the Democratic nominee. There is, as you say, another candidate, Mike Cerisi, who's another Democrat running, and they'll decide this over the next few months. But I believe now polls show that Norm Coleman loses to Al Franken as well as Cerisi, and that's current. Coleman has been dropping like a stone, and that would be a nice thing to watch in November.
Yeah, and we've got 20-some-odd now Republicans who in the House and Senate have said that they're not going to run for re-election. I think it's up to 26
28.
Now.
28 is 28. The new number, yep. Ladies and gentlemen. Do we hear 29? 29, do we hear 30?
Really, it's just a matter of time, I think.
It's really shocking. Now, you know, this happened to the Democrats, Tom. It happened, you know, after the so-called Gingrich Revolution in 94. Mm-hmm. Number of Democrats who had been there for a long time said, you know, I don't want to be in the minority. But the numbers here are as great, if not greater, for Republicans. They see no way of coming back. And I think, you know, there are certain elections that are decided long before, you know, any campaigning is done. And institutionally right now, it's going to be almost impossible. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's impossible for the Republicans to take back the House of Representatives in November. Not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. The mission, in my mind, frankly, isn't so much the Democrats keeping the House, because that, I hope, is a given, but rather to get a large enough Democratic majority that number of Democrats, and I've heard different numbers quoted from different experts, somewhere between 36 and 42 Democrats. You know, I think it's a 36 seat or is it 32 seat Democratic majority right now?
About 31, 32, something like that. Yeah,
okay. So 32, there's a 32 seat Democratic majority, but there's somewhere between 36 and 42 Democrats who are representing largely Republican districts.
Right.
And my understanding is that that's one of the reasons why the Democratic Party as a party, or the Democrats in the House of Representatives, have been reluctant, for example, to pursue impeachment hearings, because they're afraid, not, you know, generally of infuriating Republicans, but they're concerned about losing those 42 districts where they're representing largely Republican districts. And I'd like to see such a large majority of Democrats in the House, and so many of these so-called Republican or purple anyway, many of them, but the ones that are red districts, congressional districts, become solidly blue, that the Democrats feel that they can stand up on their hind legs and take on some of these really serious issues.
What you're calling for is a coward-proof majority.
Yes, well said.
And you know, it has been stunning to see, you know, I have great regard, I've known Nancy Pelosi a long time, great regard for her, you know, certainly her own voting record and her own history in the Congress has been, you know, tremendously progressive. She represents obviously a part of San Francisco. But the fact is that there has been, this has all been about defense. This has all been, you know, on a day when people are celebrating a Super Bowl victory, to think about any, you know, sort of effort that is all based on anticipating how you might lose and trying to avoid losing, you can never win that way. And that's how the Democrats have, in my judgment, have played it in both the House and the Senate, aiming at November, just what you said, to try and get these veto-proof majorities. I worry, though, Tom, I have to say, that that strategy undermines some of those Democratic incumbents that even came in 2 years ago with the idea that this Congress was going to stand for something. And it is very hard to make the case that, well, we are standing for something, and it's for the next election when we can do something with that majority.
I know. I've been making the point from day one that Nancy Pelosi, or from the beginning, you know, right after this Congress was elected, that, you know, it's fine to say, okay, impeachment's off the table, or pick the issue of your choice, the serious prosecution of the Bush administration, actually enforcing subpoenas, actually going out and arresting people who fail to show up, that all that stuff is off the table before the election, because Nancy Pelosi, if there was an impeachment, would be the one who would be, you know, so she's not before the election going to say, I understand that. But after the election in 2006, you know, but you and I are in agreement on this,
but we don't run the
Democratic Party. But
I would point out that I heard as recently as a few days ago from people who've been talking to John Conyers that he may yet pick up that gavel and call.
Oh, my friend Rob Call interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, about a week and a half ago. There's a YouTube video of it. Rob runs opednews.com, so I guarantee you there's a link over at opednews.com to it, where Rob asked John Conyers that question, you know, straight up, blunt out, and John Conyers said, no, impeachment is not off the table, and I'm the guy who gets to decide, not Nancy Pelosi.
And, you know, I know this is a day about, you know, elections for the Democratic and Republican nominations, but I will tell you that I do not think, people make this argument to me all the time, well, David, how is it possible to have impeachment during, you know, it's an election year, people want to move on, it's only going to hurt Democrats. It's actually just the opposite if people are paying attention to history at all. The only way to leave a record about everything that has been wrong, constitutionally wrong with this administration, is by holding the hearings. You don't have to have a vote. You don't even have to have articles of impeachment.
That's right.
But you leave a record that the next Congress and the next president will have to pay attention to.
Right. And I think that, you know, there ever since the Ford pardon of Nixon, there has been this, well, let's cut him some slack attitude among presidents, even of opposite parties. Bill Clinton did the same thing. He walked away from the ongoing investigations and prosecutions of Iran-Contra, figuring that it would be too divisive.
Absolutely right.
And he never should have done that. He should have held those guys accountable. Even the ones that Bush the elder pardoned on the way out, Caspar Weinberger and some of these other criminals, even though they were pardoned, there still should have been investigations into what happened.
Our long national nightmare may not actually have been over.
No, it is not over. I'm telling you, it's been ongoing since Nixon. The Republican corruption is mind-boggling. But, you know, c'est la vie. So what tonight, election coverage, we're talking, by the way, with David Bender, if you just tuned in, the senior political correspondent here at Air America Radio, airamerica.com, and David and Mark Green are going to be doing election coverage tonight, along with a whole bunch of us dropping by, John Kerry, Barbara Boxer, Gary Hart, Al Franken, the mayor, whose name you can pronounce better than me.
Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles.
Villaraigosa.
And we are going to be talking, you know, it is going to be coast-to-coast coverage, Tom, but the idea is actually we're going to be hearing from people who are supporting both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, in some cases still making their closing arguments before the polls close in California.
Right, yeah, and we did this by and large yesterday on this program. I had, you know, surrogates for both campaigns on talking about the issues. What we didn't do, and we probably, you know, in retrospect, it might have been interesting, would be to have McCain and Romney people on as well. But
and more power to you. I actually think you should, you know, why don't you get Bob Dole on and see if he can say, tell Mitt Romney stop lying about my record.
Yeah, right. I think these days all he's talking about is Viagra. I mean,
one thing that is interesting and to look for tonight is that in California, particularly with literally millions of ballots having been cast absentee and by mail, there is talk now that we will not have all of the votes counted. This could be playing out well into tomorrow, and I'm seeing some reports that suggest the delegates, the all important delegate counts. I sounded just like Brian Williams there, didn't I? The all important delegate counts. That they're going to need some days possibly to figure out congressional districts to get the apportionment. We may not know until Friday all the delegate results.
Amazing. David Bender, you can listen, tune in tonight, airamerica.com, and on selected stations around the country. David, our senior political correspondent here at Air America Radio. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Tom. See you tonight.
Yep. See you tonight. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There you go. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com. Go to the Tom Hartman page on AirAmerica.com or TomHartman.com. Click on chat and drop in and say hi. I hang out there during the breaks. And also our message board, our blogs, and all kinds of stuff. There's all different kinds of ways to communicate with us, as well as calling in. James in Massachusetts. Hey, James. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Tom, for taking my phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to call about this whole experience issue that a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters are talking about and place into perspective. Hillary Clinton was sworn in 2000. Barack Obama sworn in 2005. My question is this. If it's a matter of elected experience that pushes Hillary Clinton supporters so much, then why didn't they support Chris Dodd, who has over 24 years of experience? Why didn't they support Senator Biden, whose experience goes back to as early as 1973? Why didn't they support Bill Richardson, who has experience both as a governor and also in Washington? Finally, it's not just a matter of Barack Obama's experience in Washington. He also has 8 years' worth of experience as a state senator from Illinois. That's state and federal elected experience.
Right, which is no small thing, and the voters of Illinois know him quite well. Good point, James. I think what's happened is that we tend to drop things into frames. Words become shorthand for other things. And experience has become the shorthand that the Clinton campaign uses to basically frame or describe in a positive way in their minds Hillary Clinton, and change has become the frame or the phrase that the Obama campaign has used or is using to try to as shorthand for his campaign. And so, you know, when you and I parse out these words, you know, I think that we could both argue that, you know, change, you know, is Obama's definition of change is not quite as great as some of us would like, and Hillary Clinton's definition of experience is arguable. But, you know, the bottom line is that those are the words that the candidates have chosen, that their campaigns have chosen. Those are the frames. And I think that we all know that it's really about a whole lot more than that. But your point is well taken, James. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Rick in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tom. This is good. And you got a good segue here. I want to talk about Reagan and Van Morrison and Obama and Kennedy and
Morrison, one of my favorite musicians. How did he get in there?
It started when I was listening, and one line in his thing was, meet them halfway with love, peace, and persuasion.
Right.
Expect them to rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
And how, you know, you talk about Reagan and what he did to us militarily and economically, but I think that...
Well, he also ran on racism. You know, he kicked off his campaign down in the South in a city where there had been just a horrific racial incident. I'm sorry, I don't recall or have the details right in front of me, but and talking about states' rights, which was everybody knew was, you know, code for institutionalized racism and segregation, and he ran on a functionally a very racist platform as well.
Right. Yeah, and I want to talk about the semantics of that love and that peace and what it used to be back after John Kennedy came in and we had hope in America and what we could do with that hope and that love. And I would submit that Reagan and all the successive Republicans and by default the conservatives ripped that all away from us, and they've been trying to ever since.
It's still there, though. Hope, as Studs Terkel titled his last book, as I recall, "Hope Dies Last." You know,
but I would also submit that that's part of this change that Barack is talking about, and he can't put it into those real words.
Yeah.
But that's what America is feeling.
Yeah, Rick, a good point. It is meta. I mean, Barack Obama's message of change is appealing to hope and is meta to a whole lot of other things. And that's a marvelous thing. It's a marvelous meme, regardless of which candidate wins. I believe either one of them will carry that forward. David in Portland. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. First, long time, first time.
Thank you.
Anyway, when it comes on to the healthcare issues, healthcare plans, as a new citizen of USA, it seems to me that affordability and availability is the issue for me. Now, since you seem to understand the issues more than most people that I know, that's why I am putting the question to you. Well, my mom came to visit last year, and she fell and hit her knee. We couldn't get health care anywhere. We went to our doctor, and we wanted to pay him to look at it, and he wouldn't. He said he couldn't. He wanted to go the insurance way. So the question is, which of these plans better address if you have visitors to the USA and they get injured and get health care?
Well, my opinion, David, is whoa, I didn't see that break coming. I'm sorry. David, let me answer your question. Excuse me. Yeah, David, let me answer your question after we come back from the break here on the other side.
Okay.
I appreciate it. It's not an easy answer, I have some concerns with both plans. We'll get into that. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
As we lie beneath the stars, we realize how small we are. If they could love like you and me, imagine what the world could be.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers of SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right in America, not a privilege, which gets right to the point of the last caller. And I want to share my riff with you about the Clinton and versus the Obama health care programs. Let me preface this by saying I would not vote for or against either candidate based on the health care programs that they are putting forward at this moment. Because anything that's put forward in a primary campaign is basically, hey, here's an idea. That's about what it amounts to. It will ultimately, you know, then you're going to have the national campaign. Everything's going to get tweaked. Then you get the election. And if the person gets elected, then you have to negotiate with Congress. And so much can change and does change, always does change. So I wouldn't base my vote just on this. In fact, I would just make this like one small factor in it. So first of all, Hillary Clinton's health care plan, from what I understand of the two of these, and I don't represent myself as an expert on these two plans, merely a well-informed voter, let's say. Hillary Clinton's plan requires everybody to participate. Barack Obama's plan does not. Now, there's an upside and a downside to both of those. The upside to Hillary Clinton's plan that requires everybody to participate is that the only way you're going to get truly universal coverage in the United States and the only way you're going to get actually a lowered cost for everybody is if everybody is required to participate. Because otherwise you're going to have particularly young and healthy people who very often will go for decades without health insurance because they just figure they don't need it. I mean, you know, they're worried about a car accident. That's about the worst thing. In some cases, they'll just have catastrophic insurance, if any. That when you bring those people into a pool, it lowers the cost for everybody. It spreads the risk around for everybody. It's the reason why Social Security is mandatory. It's the reason one of the reasons why car insurance is mandatory for everybody. Actually, that's an imperfect metaphor, but not entirely, because if somebody crashes into your car, you want to know that they're insured. If somebody gets sick with, say, an infectious disease like tuberculosis, you want to know that they're insured, that they'll go to a doctor quickly, They may think they have the flu. They'll go to the doctor quickly. They'll find out it's something serious, and that way you won't get their TB the next time you're sitting next to them in a bus or an airplane. So her mandates make her program, in my opinion, a better program. Now, here's the downside of Hillary Clinton's mandates. In the general election, if she is the nominee, the Republicans are going to say, Hillary Clinton wants to garnish your wages. And in fact, I mean, that's basically the Barack Obama camp is already saying things like that. And so his health care plan is a better political strategy for the general election. And I think he's looking forward to the general election. You want to defeat the Republicans, then the more effective way to do it is to say, oh, our plan has choice built into it. You don't have to participate. The government's not going to come knocking on your door if you don't participate. And that's something that the centrists, the middle-of-the-road Americans, some of the Republicans, the Reagan Democrats, in quotes, can probably more easily accept than you must. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton's program is a plan, in my opinion, is the one that's more likely to actually get everybody in this country covered. Now, all that said, neither one of their plans are single-payer health insurance. Both of their plans keep intact these giant leeches on our body politic and on our bodies themselves, you know, metaphorically, I suppose, but you could argue even literally, the health insurance companies and some of the for-profit HMOs and some of these businesses. I mean, you know, Bill Frist, for example, I mean, his daddy became a billionaire as a result of the way the system is rigged. One of the richest men in America. You got William McGuire from United Health, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, the one that provides the health insurance for AARP, which is basically just another health insurance company, or another insurance company, basically. That's what AARP is. You got William McGuire taking a $1.78 billion compensation package. I say, what? That's our health care money. And both these plans preserve those companies intact. And so, you know, I've got a serious problem with both of them. So, anyway, that's my take on that. I think that Hillary Clinton's plan is the better plan. I think that Barack Obama's plan is the least destructive to a Democratic candidate who's running in a national election. And so, again, we're back to go flip a coin. Stanley in New York City. Hey, Stanley, what's up?
Hey, I've worked for the New York City Board of Elections on Election Day as a poll worker.
Mm-hmm.
I've also worked as a poll watcher during the Gore election.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got to work for the New York City Board of Elections counting affidavit ballots. Mm-hmm. As, to quote Barbara Boxer, in the first vote of 2005, electoral justice. I'm very concerned about electoral justice.
Mm-hmm.
It's why I supported John Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a real problem with Barbara Boxer standing up alone concerning the Ohio vote.
Yep.
But one positive way for people to be effective is not only working and volunteering for candidates, but it's getting jobs with your local Board of Elections mm-hmm. on Election Day.
You're right. Okay. You're absolutely right, Stanley. And I salute you for doing so, and thank you for bringing the topic up for our listeners. It's God bless you. It's great what you're doing. Jack in Wisconsin. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Hello. A couple comments.
Mm-hmm.
One reason why I'm not supporting Hillary against Obama, I mean, I will vote for either one. I mean, I've been listening to Hillary. Hillary sounds really good. You know, I like the whole idea of a woman running and all that. But I don't like the DLC, and I don't like the conservative branch that she comes out of, which is a neoliberal collusion with the neocons in their way of dealing with business and stuff like that.
Now, let me just flip that around for a second. Did you hear Carl Bernstein? He was on one of the talk shows a couple days ago. You know, he wrote the kind of the definitive biography of Hillary Clinton. And he said that when Bill was pushing NAFTA and WTO and all that stuff, she was in the background yelling, don't do it, it's wrong, that she is far more liberal than her husband?
Well, okay, that may be so, but then she needs to distance herself from the DLC and that whole type of thing. Obama does it, but I'm also a clinical social worker, and I like his community organization. He really does take that tact that if I was an organizer, I want to see something change.
Mm-hmm.
It has a pragmatic and it's an uplifting and a positive approach of trying to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that whole thing. Now, the other, that's my why I lean his way. Because of that approach, because again, I can't emphasize how much importance that approach is if you're going to get things done. Now, the whole thing about healthcare, you and I both know that the times are upon us, that, you know, these other plans are not going to hold water. You're going to have a single-payer plan to solving things, particularly with Medicare, as I look as a baby boomer come up, because it ain't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, they're going to have to be forced to do something about the military. We don't need a huge military that's larger than all the militaries put together. Substantial savings, which Bill did do by cutting back on the military, is going to have to happen. But here's where Obama comes in. He has said in a more internationalist way that we have to work with the UN and we have to make it work, and that's the only way we're going to really get that kind of cuts that we need in order to take care of our domestic policies.
Yeah.
So that's why I lean Obama.
Yeah, okay, I got it, Jack. Thank you very much. Yeah, and he has said those things, and I agree with him on those in those regards. Richard in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Richard, you wanted to disagree with me?
Well, you've been representing, you're being a little more fair to Obama today, but for weeks and weeks, everyone's been talking about this 15 million people kind of made up calculation that wouldn't be insured under Obama's plan. I think people miss the whole point of Obama's plan is that we've got a healthcare system that is so full of overinflated profit that it's a laughingstock around the world.
Yep.
And Obama's plan is to cut out a lot of that profit. And I think Hillary's plan barely addresses that, but forces everyone to buy into a broken and inflated system. But Obama's plan is to be a lot more like the way Canada, you know, they refuse to sell, you know, they say that pill's not worth $20, that pill's worth $2. And that's why people are buying American drugs back off of Canadian drugstores over the internet and stuff, because Canada says no on that. And Obama doesn't owe any favors to those evil powers, and so his plan is to actually make them have to bargain it down to a reasonable price for the healthcare providers, the insurance and the pharma.
Yeah, there are some very good dimensions of his program that do that. You're right. And without a national system, though, in both cases, I mean, this is where, again, a single payer system or some variation on a single payer system like Canada or Switzerland have, that's sort of a hybrid, but there's a single payer piece to it.
But that's where we get to that. It's a segue.
No, I understand, Richard, and I agree with you. And I think both of these plans are great compared to what we have right now, because what we have right now is a disaster. So, you know, anyhow, my take on it, and thank you, Richard, for your thoughts. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com. Stick around.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. Our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And we're all assisted in those efforts by the 200,000 health and hospital workers of SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, suggesting that keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Is there a D in privilege? You know, it's one of those words I've never been able to spell right. It's, I've got like, you know, four or five words that are just totally, don't get it. Anyway, pardon my digression. U.S. troops are voting with their dollars, with their pocketbooks. Now, those of you who are longtime listeners to the program know that I cringe at that phrase because this is a democracy, and if people vote with their dollars, you know, people say, oh, you can vote with your dollars for that, then that means people with the most dollars have the most votes, and that's not democracy. That said, members of the military are now among the largest donators to federal candidates for president of the United States. The Center for Responsive Politics just did a study. I mean, all this stuff is public, right? When you make a campaign donation, you have to disclose who your employer is and what your job is with them. Individuals in the Army, Navy, and Air Force made those branches. This is from this report from the Center for Responsive Politics. Individuals in the Army, Navy, and Air Force made those branches of the armed forces among the top contributors in the fourth quarter, ranking number 13, number 18, and number 21, respectively. Now, who are they giving all this money to? Since members of the Air Force, Army, and Navy are, among, you know, in aggregate, represent one of the largest blocks of giving cash to campaign donations. Are they giving it to John McCain, who wants 100 years or more war? Are they giving it to Mitt Romney, who wants 1,000 years or more war? Are they giving it to Mike Huckabee, who's, you know, probably 500 years or more war? No, it turns out that number one recipient of that money was Ron Paul, the Republican who says this war was a mistake and we need to get out tomorrow morning. Number two, Barack Obama, who says, you know, this war was a mistake and we need to get out over the course of the next year. So the service members, as much as McCain and Bush and Cheney and all these guys want to claim them as, hey, they're on our side, they love us, blah, 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 blah. Bottom line, service members are voting with their pocketbooks. And again, I use that phrase with my perennial caveat for Barack Obama and for Ron Paul. Mike in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Oh, yeah, hi. This is this is Mike. That came quick. I was going to call about my support for Senator Obama and why I thought that the charges of his inexperience were not necessarily accurate, but instead, hearing the talk about voting and about getting involved and getting active, I figured I'd talk a little bit about my personal story, my own experience about that.
And that is?
Am I on the air right now?
You are. You have been all along.
Oh, my goodness.
So okay. If you can cut to the chase, I'd appreciate it, because we got about 2 minutes and a bunch of other people would like to pop in here.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, like I was saying, you know, I've always been on the left. I was a little bit too left to be a Democrat for a while. After hearing the 2004 speech, I decided that it wouldn't be too bad to join the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. Since then, I interned for Congressman John Dingell. I've I campaign managed for a Democrat running for state representative, and I've done get out the votes for lots of other Democratic candidates. I've been an active member. Now I'm a precinct delegate, and I'm running for uncommitted since I live in Michigan, and we didn't have the ability to vote for Barack Obama or anybody.
Right.
Now, since I've been, you know, and I'm not doing it to tout, you know, toot my own horn or anything like that, but what I am saying is that this is the energy, this is the message and the overall campaign theme that Barack Obama has brought to this election, and that's going to do nothing but help the Democratic Party and, more importantly, this country.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Mike. I think that, you know, whether Obama is the nominee or not, he has done a tremendous service to this country by his candidacy. And whether he's the candidate or not, he's not going away. This is a young guy. He's going to be around for a while. Ellen in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Ellen.
Hello.
Hello, Ellen. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I saw Hillary on Letterman last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of leaning towards, well, since Edwards abdicated, I was kind of leaning towards Obama. But when Hillary got on Letterman last night and said three little words that threw me right into her camp, she was talking about the mortgage crisis, and she mentioned the prepayment penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm stuck on one of those. I took bad advice and got stuck with a loan that even if I refinance with the company that owns the mortgage, they'll charge me $7,000 to refinance it.
Yeah.
Unless I wait two more years.
Yeah, it's obscene. And in many cases, people got these little gotchas, you know, buried on page 16, paragraph 3 in the fine print and never even knew
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's the only one that's mentioned. She said prepayment penalty, and she's the only one that's mentioned, you know, anything close to that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Thank you. Or I don't know if she's the only one who's mentioned anything close to it, but it is an excellent point. Thank you, Ellen, very much. Greg in Los Angeles. Hey, Greg.
Hey, you know, I'm concerned about the election fraud just like you are, and like everybody else in this country who thinks their votes count.
Yep.
But just like that money-based campaigning where people have to vote with their pocketbooks, or black box voting, you know, where their votes are changed by passwords, I'm worried about these super delegates who can flip-flop and change what people voted for.
Yeah, well, they won't change what you voted for, but they can swing the election. And, you know, that's something that the Democratic Party has worked out, and they think it works well, and, you know, it's okay with me. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, we'll be checking in. Mark Green is going to be here to talk about the Democrats and how they did in Super Tuesday. And Terrence Jeffrey, the editor of CNS News, will be here to talk about the Republican side of the ledger on the roundup. So tune in back in with us tomorrow, Wednesday. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out and vote. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.